I arrived in Germany September 2nd, 1972. I came from Syria via Yugoslavia. I was alone. In Syria, two leaders of the group Black September ordered me to take part in the kidnapping of the Israeli athletes in the Munich Olympic Village. These two leaders, named Tony and Issa, handed me a descriptive sketch displaying the Olympic area and marked the situation of an underground station where I should meet them at September 3rd, 1972, 6 p.m.
This was a quote from a testimony delivered by one of the Palestinian terrorists who turned the heitere, cheerful Olympic Games in Munich into bloody Olympic Games 50 years ago. This episode tells a story about how the terrorists were recruited and prepared, who they were, who and where they lived, and who led and recruited them. One of these young Arabic Palestinians was Abd el-Qadir al-Tnawi. His name was wrong, of course. That's the one he told the police. And for the time being, we will continue to name him al-Tnawi, simply because this is how he is called in most of the investigation files. And to spoil a not so unimportant fact right in the beginning, the terrorist's attack against Team Israel did not end tragically for him. He was not killed. He was one of three who survived, unlike all of the Israeli athletes. And unlike most of his comrades in terror, as well as his leaders Issa and Tony. Al-Tnawi survived, and no, he never paid for taking hostages and killing them all. He was never prosecuted. He never had to show up in court. He was never sentenced to anything. On the contrary, shortly after committing this crime, he was released and celebrated as a hero. And you know what? He is still alive, 50 years later. And still today, German investigators, prosecutors or judges don't even try to get him. Although they should know where he is, as others know as well.
Geheimakte 1972. Das Olympia-Attentat in München.
Hallo Tunis, wir haben die israelische Mannschaft in unserer Gewalt.
My brother came to do sport in the Olympics and they were murdered there.
Die ganze Geschichte, investigativ recherchiert. Bisher unveröffentlichtes Material.
I was contacted by a German journalist, Christoph Lemmer.
Geheimakte 1972. Ein Antenne Bayern Group Podcast von Christoph Lemmer.
Hochweg September mehr allein, ach hat es sah.
Episode 2. Issa und Toni.
Kaisheim Prison in Bavaria, September 20th, 1972. The accused, al-Tnawi, is being interrogated. Two police detectives ask their questions. A typist types answers and questions into a typewriter. A translator translates the questions into Arabic and the answers into German. And now, for the first time, al-Tnawi's statement in English.
I felt my identity as a Palestinian. By the time and without being pushed by someone, I became convinced that I had to join an organization that fights for our land.
And did you?
Yes. Black September.
Why this organization?
There was a cafe in our camp Shatila. This cafe was named El Fatah. I went there regularly.
Short explanation. Shatila is a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon, west of Beirut. It was founded in 1949 and is operated by a United Nations subsidy since then and still today. This is the place where al-Tnawi is said to be grown up and where he used to sit in that cafe.
A couple of times I saw two men there who did not live in the Shatila camp. One day, when I was sitting at my table, I heard other guests saying these two men were members of the Black September organization.
One more explanation. Black September made lots of headlines worldwide for its terrorist attacks. However, it was never clear if Black September was actually an organization with its own structure and personnel, or just a brand or label for terror, and in fact Yasser Arafat's Fatah or the PLO itself, just using the Black September terror brand for their own action. Today's Palestinian president in Ramallah, Mahmoud Abbas, was responsible for the Palestinians' finance affairs at that time. This will become important in one of the following episodes of this podcast, when it will be about who gave the money to plan and operate the attack against the Israeli Olympic team 1972 in Munich. Just this for now. It was not a single person. It was not an organization like an NGO. It was a state. Back to Al-Dnawi's interrogation in Kaisheim prison and the detective's next question.
When did you contact these men?
I saw them again, approximately 2 weeks after I found out that they were fedayeen. I saw them in the aforementioned cafe. I stood up and went to the table. I said hello to one of them, whom I later called Tony. I expressed my intention to join the organization Black September.
What did Tony, or this second man, Issa, answer?
Issa asked me how I knew that he and his friend were part of that organization. When I replied that I heard it somehow, he just said they would come back to the cafe within the next 2 or 3 weeks. None of the two made clear if they were part of Black September or not. 3 weeks later, they both came back into the cafe. When I came in, I immediately took a seat at their table. Issa and Tony now wanted to learn about my reason to join the group in detail. When I told them that this troop was the only chance to free our land, they seemed to be satisfied. They then noted my real name and family relationships. They wrote all this on a common piece of paper. Then they informed me that they had to be absent for a long time. They had to go on a long journey. I sat at home and waited. I did not attend school anymore at that time.
This was no surprise, since Al-Dnawi didn't go to school regularly even before that time. He said he failed his exams in 1969, 3 years earlier. His school had been operated by the UNRWA, the United Nations Subsidy for the Palestinian Refugees. UNRWA and its schools had been criticized even back then for indoctrinating children against Israel and the Jews. This criticism still exists today. Al-Dnawi said, to his knowledge, he could continue school in Germany, study and learn languages there. So he went to Germany after he failed with his school in Shatila.
How did you travel to Germany?
I took a plane from Beirut to Budapest, and from there to East Berlin. From there, I took a bus to pass the border to West Germany, where my passport was stamped.
What kind of passport did you have?
I had a Lebanese passport, as I was Lebanese citizen with the additive Palestinian. The passport was issued to my real name.
Who paid this trip to Berlin, and why did you fly to East Berlin in the first place?
The trip had been financed by my family. The flight to East Berlin was cheaper compared to a flight to West Berlin. My second reason was that I had to place 1,500 German marks as a security deposit in Beirut. For traveling via East Berlin, all I needed was a transit visa.
Did you know anyone when you arrived here in Germany?
Yes, my brother lived in Berlin, as well as some Arabic friends. I knew my brother's address, but he did not know that I was arriving.
The brother worked as a plumber in Berlin. He allowed Al-Dnawi to stay in his apartment for a couple of weeks. Al-Dnawi made some money with moonlighting. His brother didn't like that. He wanted an honest life. So he placed Al-Dnawi in a plane back to Beirut after 3 or 4 weeks.
Then, in September 1970, I repeated my exam, but failed again. I planned to attend a special class to try it for the third time. At our place, it is possible to try the exams as often as you want. But in spring 1971, I left school for a political reason.
Political reason? Well, this is really pompous. This political reason was the meeting with Issa and Tony in the cafe and their announcement he should wait for until they would get back to him.
After 2 or 2.5 months, Tony and Issa came back. We met in the cafe again. This time they wanted 2 pictures of me. They did not tell what they needed them for. Of course, I didn't have any pictures of me with me and had to return home.
About a year before the Munich attack, things got serious.
By the time we drove to this cafe by the sea, it was September 1971. On this day, I was ordered to go on a trip on the last day of October. I was advised to take a shared taxi to Damascus early in the morning. It would await me at the Marji Plaza. By noon, around 1 p.m., I arrived at the plaza. I had to wait there for about an hour. They were both late. They came without a car.
What did you have to do in Damascus?
As mentioned earlier, I wanted to join the Black September organization. When the two said, travel to Damascus, I was not in a position to question that. In Damascus, we went to a hotel. It was just a 5-minute walk away from the taxi stop. I assume its name was Nuza. There I was told that I was now an official member of the Black September organization.
What did they tell you about the Black September's objectives?
Black September's objective is to expel the Israeli people from Palestine and to overthrow King Hussein. We did not have any specific job. We were just waiting for orders.
Here again a short remark on the historical context. It was September 1970 when Palestinian extremists tried to kill King Hussein of Jordan. They failed. Jordan army and police after that expelled the PLO from Jordan. This is where the name Black September comes from. In the following years, Palestinians committed lots of terrorist attacks, murder, plane hijacks, and the attack against Team Israel at the Olympics in Munich 1972.
Did you endorse these attacks?
Yes.
Did you want to take part in those attacks? Is it this why you joined this organization?
If there's an action against murderers and traitors, I was willing to take part in it.
To make this clear, you decided to join this organization, willing to kill people if they have different political views that are different than yours?
This is correct. I joined this organization to kill traitors within our own people and Jordanians who killed about 30,000 Palestinians.
How did you come to his view? You had a quiet and respectable childhood. Your family didn't have any particular difficulties.
It's a problem of my people. It's about the land.
Are there other members of your family who joined this organization?
I don't know about anyone in my family to have joined the organization. This is each individual's problem. I assume that my younger brothers will do the same when they become older.
Your brother is older. What did he do?
As far as I know, he doesn't belong to any organization.
Aznavi's last meeting with Issa and Tony took place October 31st, 1971, a little less than a year before the Munich attack. Aznavi now was a member of Black September. However, he was not allowed to talk about that to anybody.
Issa informed me that we would spend the night in Damascus and return to Beirut the next day. Back there, I should look for work. Issa said no one should know about what we did. We would meet again after approximately half a year. He said he would approach me on his initiative.
Next day, Aznavi took the bus back to Beirut. He said he was returning to his parents in Shatila.
But there, I didn't look for work. I stayed with my parents. Until May of 1972, I didn't work at all. I often walked around or went to the cinema.
How could you afford to go to the cinema or similar things when you had no income?
I was supported by my family.
When did Issa and Tony contact you again?
It was April or May 1972 when they showed up again in the cafe in Shatila. Issa explained to me that we again would travel to Damascus. He told me that this time I would get trained with weapons. When I told Issa that I didn't have any money, he handed me 25 Lebanese pounds. 2 days later, I drove to Damascus. As agreed, I met the two. Issa had told me to have my passport with me to not get into trouble when entering Jordan as a Palestinian. Right after meeting Issa, I entered a cab for Amman. Tony took the next cab for the same direction. He did that to avoid difficulties when passing the border to Jordan.
So, buses and cabs. winding path from Beirut to Jordan. First leg to Damascus in Syria, route by Hafiz al-Assad, father of today's Syrian dictator Bashar, and close friend to the radicals among the Palestinians. From Damascus to Amman in Jordan, border guards asked everyone for their reason for their travel to Jordan. As told by Issa, Al-Tanawi lied and said he was visiting relatives. From Amman, the last leg of the trip was to Jerash, an ancient town in the north of Jordan.
After arriving at the taxi stand, Issa and I went about 5 minutes to the right. We approached a single-story house with a small garden. Issa rang the doorbell. A man opened up and welcomed Issa with a hug. I had to assume that they knew each other better. Both of them spoke Arabic with a Palestinian accent. About an hour later, Tony arrived as well. Afternoon, the men left and we stayed. Issa told me he would bring a Kalashnikov. Around 9 p.m., the man came back, but didn't bring a weapon. We had dinner. Tony, Issa, and myself then slept in the living room. The next day, we didn't do anything. We didn't even leave the house. But the man left in the morning and returned by noon. Maybe he went to work. In the afternoon, he left again and came back around 9 p.m. In a bag, he had a Kalashnikov. Issa opened the bag, took me by his side, and showed me the gun. It was a weapon of the same kind that we had in Munich. It had two magazines tied together with duct tape. Both magazines were loaded with ammunition. We went to another room. Issa showed me how to disassemble and assemble the gun. I imitated everything he did.
This had been the first time in his life that someone taught him how to handle a weapon, Al-Tanawi said during his interrogation. The training continued over the next 2 weeks. Then Issa and Tony sent Al-Tanawi back home. He again had to wait. Mid of August 1972, the two showed up again, 3 weeks before the attack in Munich.
They ordered me to come to the marketplace in Damascus on August 22nd, 1972. As I did before, I had to travel in the morning and take a taxi. They didn't give me any money. They just said I should go to Damascus and have my passport with me. When I arrived, they were already waiting for me at the taxi stand. From there, I walked for about 10 minutes. Issa had a key to an apartment on the ground floor. There was no nameplate. It was a two-room apartment which was fully furnished. A few minutes later, Issa and Tony took my passport and left the apartment. I stayed by myself. I looked at it and noticed a new tourist visa for Germany, valid, I guess, for a month period, and a transit visa for Yugoslavia.
Here we need to interrupt, because this notice from Al-Tanawi's interrogation is confusing. It says that Issa and Tony took his passport, but at the same time that Al-Tanawi looks into his passport and finds the new visa. One has to leave open what happened in detail. The interesting thing is that somehow Issa and Tony should have managed to get new visas into Al-Tanawi's passport without him knowing how. Back to Al-Tanawi's statement.
Issa said there is a plan for an action in Germany. To be correct, Issa said my work would be in Germany. He did not explain what kind of work it would be. We had not spoken about this. I didn't even think about it. For me, an order was an order. Tony and Issa also said we would meet in Germany. They gave me a ticket, meaning a flight ticket of the East German Interflug airline and a flight on August 29th, 1972 from Damascus to Belgrade. Issa told me to take a cab from the airport to the railway station. There I could enter a train that would bring me to Munich without further train switching. The train ticket would cost around $40. My arrival in Munich would be scheduled between September 2nd and 3rd. Meeting point should be an underground station. Issa had written the name of the station on a paper sheet. I was due to arrive there September 3rd, 1971, at 6 p.m.
He then did not meet Issa and Tony in Damascus. Al-Tanawi stayed in the Syrian capital until August 29th. Issa and Tony had put him up in a hotel there for almost 1 week. They also gave him money,
50 Syrian liras, 40 US dollars and 700 German marks. His departure was around 8 a.m. on August 29th. Issa and Tony had also made their way to Munich by other means. How exactly they traveled has never been fully elucidated, but where in Munich they resided has. One of their hotels was the Hotel Salzburg, strictly speaking, the leadership of the terrorist operation resided there.
File notice. Detective Department Roman 1, A1, Munich. Mrs. Grieswelle is the daughter of the owner of the Hotel Salzburg in Munich, Senefelder Street number 1. There she worked every Monday. While doing so, she met one of her guests called Tony. He was of Arabic ancestry and pretended to be Tunisian. Allegedly, he only spoke English. He was a guest in her parents' hotel. Tony insisted in meeting Mrs. Grieswelle in private, but she denied. He asked her to at least allow her to send her a Christmas card. Not to offend him, she wrote her phone number into his notebook without mentioning the name of her address in Grünwald.
And further in the police file.
According to the investigation, there were three people staying in the Hotel Salzburg in Munich who, with absolute certainty, were involved in the terrorist attack against the Israeli Olympic team. Two of them have been recognized without any doubt by the hotel's owner's daughter after looking at photographs shown to her.
Their names as written on their hotel registration?
Alkuri Yessa.
Yessa. Yessa was just another spelling for Issa. Witnesses recognized him as one of the terrorists who had been killed later during the shootout on the airfield Fürstenfeldbruck.
Talal.
Talal remains a phantom until today. While Tony and Issa were the operational leaders of the Munich terror attack, Talal seems to be above them within the Palestinian hierarchy. The hotel's service personnel describe him as groomed, polite and temperate. He didn't leave his handwriting anywhere. It was Tony who signed his hotel registration stating Talal as his friend.
Kartu Hamid.
Kartu is the one who was called Tony. He was recognized by witnesses as well as one of the terrorists killed in Fürstenfeldbruck. The files prove that Tony spent almost all of August in the Hotel Salzburg in Munich, in particular the days between August 8th and August 25th. Then he moved to another place in Munich. He posted an ad in a Munich newspaper looking for a private room and some family connection. He was successful and got accommodated by the elderly couple N. Mrs. N. testified.
It was then agreed that he could move in August 25th, 72 in the morning. Around 11 a.m. I saw the taxi coming. My lodger left the car and took his luggage into the apartment. He told me that he would leave again right away and just got rid of the luggage. Then he went back to the taxi. I also want to say that he already had paid 100 marks when he introduced himself to us and another 200 marks in advance when he came with his luggage. It was agreed that he would stay with us for 2 months.
But in fact, he just stayed a couple of days.
He left on September 1st in the afternoon with his luggage. I looked at him and saw as he stepped into a tram.
And finally, the police investigator asked if Mrs. N learned anything about his personal business.
All I know is what my husband told me, who could speak to him in English. He said he was from Algeria and worked there for an American oil company. Now he was on vacation traveling for 7 months all over Europe. He spoke about Germany, Sweden, Spain, Yugoslavia and Switzerland. He also said his parents had passed away when he was just 5 years old and that he had inherited their fortune.
Well, most likely, all of this is false. Nothing of this was true. Even Mrs. N doubted it. Tony had told her that he was 29 years old, she told the police, but in his passport his age was 30. Same with Issa. He manipulated his biography too. In the Hotel Salzburg he claimed to be an attorney. The service personnel said Issa was much more temperate than Tony and more sympathetic. He spoke perfect German with a little French accent, which was a very distinct marker, which became very important a couple of days later, during the attack against the Israeli team. Issa was the man with the white hat, the one who presented himself as the leader, the one who was looked after even by Germany's Minister of the Interior, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, the one whose looks made it into TV sets and newspaper front pages all over the world. What did these men do in Germany during August 1972, 50 years ago? How could they move and travel so freely and uncontrolled? The public security services must have had a clue of what was going on. In the depth of the state's archives, I found two very interesting documents touching this issue. Firstly, an application for a residence permit for Germany. This form lies within a file that is classified until 2042. It is printed on yellow paper. It had been filled out and submitted at the German embassy in Tripolis, Libya, at July 19th, 1972. Just a couple of months prior the terrorists' attack in Munich. The name, as it is written into the form.
Surname, Al-Khoury. First names, Yessa Fuat. Birthday, 1945. Citizenship, Jordanian. Planned stay in the Federal Republic of Germany, Munich, due the Olympics. Planned duration, July 26th until October 26th, 1972. Sources for needed expenses from own pocket.
A passport photograph showing a friendly-looking young man is glued to that paper. Full, smooth, slightly wavy hair combed from the right to the left. Patterned shirt, no jacket. And with a red, thick, colored pencil, an officer wrote all across this application, rejected. Did the German state officers know who this man was and what he really had planned? Chances are high. Here, finding number two. Germany had been warned in advance. On August 21st, 2 weeks prior to the attack, the police received a notice from the German Secret Service. It is marked as not confirmed and not highly precise, but its message is quite clear anyway. It says, from Palestinian side, there will be an incident incinerated. No further detail is available except this. Palestinian terrorist groups are said to be traveling to Germany, started travel August 30th and September 2nd to unknown destination and unknown operation. Let's dive deeper and get some real insights. Who created the idea? Who gave the money? Who planned it? And who ordered it? In the next episode, we meet the mastermind of the Munich attack, the man who himself admitted being the mastermind, the man who arranged everything and had help from German neo-Nazis. His name, Abu Daoud. You like this podcast? Consider writing a review, sharing it with your friends, or clicking like or full 5 stars. You feel you have something to contribute? Contact me via email to geheimakte@antenne.de.
Geheimakte 1972. 50 Jahre nach dem Olympia-Attentat in München. Ein Podcast der Antenne Bayern Group.